Bringing balance into the digital age.
Sometimes less is more, particularly in moments when you don't have to be connected. You know, I'm thinking of those optional times, walking down the sidewalk in a beautiful city. Do you really have to look at your mobile 5 times in the space of one block?
That's William Powers. We talked to him about how humans have dealt with new information technology throughout the ages and what we can learn from them. His book is Hamlet's Blackberry.
Do you find yourself getting less done now that you have constant access to limitless information? When you're in the middle of a conversation or a meeting, is it difficult for you not to take that cell phone call or check your BlackBerry?
And that's Joanne Cantor talking about cyber overload. She has help for those who answer yes to those questions and others she poses in her book, Conquer Cyber Overload. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Once upon a time, writing was new technology. Socrates bewailed that it would debase culture, alienating human beings from each other and cutting them off from nature. Sound familiar? We live in a digital age, but do we have to be ruled by it? Journalist William Powers says we need balance, not reject what we have, but learn to live more intelligently and happily with it. And the issue is far from new. He says people have been struggling with the distractions of new information technology for 2,000 years. His book, Hamlet's Blackberry, finds inspiration in how such sages as Socrates, Seneca, Gutenberg, Thoreau, and others confronted the new tech conundrum and the solutions they found. Well, William Powers, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
You have a telling anecdote in the book about an epiphany that you had while driving to your mother's house. I wonder if you could tell us that story.
Yes, it was a sort of a mundane moment, in all honesty, but sometimes those mundane moments have the most meaning. And in this case, I was driving to my mother's house to visit her. She lives a few hours away from me. I was late, as usual, so I called her on my mobile to tell her I was going to be late. And I should add parenthetically that I know it's not a good idea to make calls on the mobile, but I did it, like many people. And we had a brief utilitarian conversation about my lateness, and we hung up. And as I hung up, I looked at my mobile where a picture of her comes up automatically when I call her. I looked at the picture, and I closed the phone and put it in the cup holder and ended the connection. And then something amazing happened in the car. I sort of had this moment of kind of elevated awareness of my mother and my relationship with my mother. All these memories of her came flooding back, all flowing out of that little phone call I just had with her, until it was like the car, as I write in the book, the car was like a floating cloud of mom, as it were, a momness. And I realized later, in thinking about this moment, that it only happened because I ended the connection and opened up a little gap of time between myself and my digital device. If I had gone on to another phone call or a text or one of these other digital tasks that we perform all day, I never would have had that excellent moment where I took my conversation with my mother to a deeper place. And I sort of spend much of my book exploring that idea of how important gaps like that are in this connected world.
And also exploring the idea of balance, because after all, if you hadn't had the cell phone, you also wouldn't have had that moment.
Right. So it's this idea that connectedness is wonderful. You know, my book is not at all about running away from digital technology, which I love and use, you know, all the time, and has so much potential to enrich our lives. But I do think we get more out of it if we have balance and if we're not constantly being led around by our screens and really being kept busy by our screens, not just busy in the literal sense of too much to do on our to-do list, but busy internally inside our minds, too much going on, too much information. I just don't think that's the recipe for a happy life.
And, you know, you say, as you say, we are out of balance on this, and there's a tremendous social pressure, I think, to be more and more connected all the time. And you say that as well. I mean, for example, I don't have a smartphone. I have a regular cell phone for just those kinds of emergencies you talked about. And sometimes I found that I'm actually ashamed to admit that I don't have a smartphone professionally. You know, as a journalist, people expect me to have one.
Yeah, it's true. You know, it's reached the point where people really expect you to be connected and reachable all the time, partly because that's how they live and they think it's the norm, but also partly because it's become a kind of a cultural impetus. You know, you read about it in the news all the time. You're constantly hearing people talking about how we live in the digital age. This is what it's all about, constant connectivity. It sounds great, and the ability to connect is, of course, wonderful. But the reality of being always connected, or what I call digital maximalism, which is really basically the more connected you are, the better, it's not a very great reality. It winds up being, you know, if you don't have a smartphone, I think maybe I'm preaching to the choir here, you know, it winds up being less of a life than it could be. And I think we wind up getting less out of the devices than we could. Sometimes less is more, particularly in moments when you don't have to be connected. You know, I'm thinking of those optional times, walking down the sidewalk in a beautiful city. Do you really have to look at your mobile five times in the space of one block just to see if anything new has come in? I see people doing that all the time. I've done it myself. I realized in thinking about this topic as I wrote the book that that doesn't make sense.
Hmm. You know, no less a personage than Eric Schmidt of Google, you point out in your book, Hamlet's BlackBerry, you point out, had something to say about this. He actually says you should turn off and tune in.
Yes, Eric Schmidt, the chairman and CEO of Google, was asked to give the commencement speech at the University of Pennsylvania just last year. And as part of his speech, he urged the graduates, the young graduates of UPenn, to turn off their computers and turn off their phones and really go back to I forget his exact wording, but it was something like the beautiful world around us or something. You know, come back to the third dimension because there's so much there to be gained from people, direct contact with people, and from experience that isn't mediated by the screen. Of course, the chairman of Google knows how fantastic the screen can be, but I was really struck by even a person in his position recognizing, wait a minute, there's more to life than the screen, and I loved it, which is why I quote it in the book.
The third dimension.
Yeah. Remember that.
And you say in the book that, you know, the third dimension is really a place that's quite different from two dimensions. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, when I bring this up, talking about the book at bookstores and so forth, as I've been doing lately, it kind of, a lot of people are taken aback because they haven't thought of it that way. But the screen really is, you know, it's a two-dimensional way of experiencing our world. And in fact, you know, most of life and the space we move through and so forth is three dimensions. It's a world of other people and things, and we're discounting that by trying to be as connected as we can all the time through this one kind of device, the digital one. I think we're leaving behind types of communication and awareness that you can only have when you're really present in the third dimension and paying attention to it. You know, you're in the third dimension when you're facing your screen, but you're not really mindful of it. Your mind is elsewhere. And I'm finding that that's removing some parts of existence that I realize are very valuable to me. So I'm trying to help people think about how to spend more time back exactly where they are in that dimension.
It's interesting, as you're talking, I'm thinking about the studies that showed that the baby Einstein videos really don't teach infants anything, that infants have to learn in three dimensions.
Yeah, I've heard about that study. It's very interesting. I haven't read it yet, but a number of people have brought it up to me. Apparently it's gotten wide circulation. You know, think about it. To me, I cite some other research in my book about what's called embodied cognition, the idea that we are three-dimensional creatures, and there is something that's intuitively more pleasant and possibly more helpful in using three-dimensional tools, which is one of the reasons I think that some of these old-fashioned media, like paper, for example, you know, reading off a newspaper, reading off a magazine or an old-fashioned book, have persisted so much longer than people thought they would. You know, 50 years ago, they were talking about the paperless office was just around the corner, and it still hasn't happened. And in fact, the further we've gone into the computer age, the more paper we have used. So there's something about those objects and tools that you can hold and really put your fingers and hands around that work well for us, and that's why we continue using them.
And yet you also point out that the book itself was at one time the BlackBerry of its age, or the digital media of its age. It wasn't digital, but it was the new technology. So that this problem of information overload, of distraction, you actually say is 2,000 years old.
Yeah, it really is. You know, the book is a great example. Books existed, of course, before Gutenberg invented the press. There were handwritten books. And in ancient Rome, when they really had caught on and the Romans were in control of the Alexandria Library, which had hundreds of thousands of volumes, the philosopher Seneca, the Roman philosopher, spoke about how people in his circle in Rome, powerful, busy people, were really kind of driving themselves crazy trying to keep up with everything that was published. They were constantly behind. And he says rather than reading books, they had gotten into the habit of paying, quote-unquote, flying visits, reading little tiny bits of all the books and sort of pretending that they'd read them. So it was like the grazing that we do today. And what that taught me, that story, and there are many others throughout history of people feeling overloaded by a new technology, what that taught me is that, you know, we're not alone in this. People have been through versions of this before, and we can learn from their experience.
And we're talking with William Powers about his new book, Hamlet's BlackBerry, A Practical Philosophy for Building a Good Life in the Digital Age. So the book was a newfangled technology, but even before the book, your book is really a wonderful meditation, I'd say, in how human beings have confronted informational technological change throughout history. And you start back with Socrates and Plato.
Mm-hmm.
Socrates distrusted the newfangled technology of writing.
Yes, it's interesting. You know, Socrates, arguably one of the greatest minds in human history, when the alphabet came along and started to catch on in his lifetime, until then Greek society had been completely conversation-based, he looked at this newfangled device, which is what the alphabet was, and he said, no, thank you, that is going to destroy our minds. Do not use this thing called the alphabet. And I quote one of Plato's dialogues in which Socrates says just that and explains why he doesn't trust the alphabet. So it's interesting, you know, much like the people who really want to throw away digital technology today and really run away from it, people I don't agree with, you know, even a very intelligent person cannot see how many benefits can be had from the new technology because it scares them.
I had trouble wrapping my mind around the notion that Socrates would be against writing because we come so much from the prejudice, I suppose one would say, that without writing you can't have thinking.
Yeah, I know. It shows you how, you know, the context of our lives, the cultural context, and even the devices we use can so change our biases about how we think about, you know, the way life transpires and what constitutes a good life. He was dead set on the idea that a good life could not include the alphabet, which to me is so interesting because it kind of reminds you to be open-minded, not just to the device, but to how we're using it. Perhaps the latest devices are full of promise, but only if you use them wisely. You know, you have to learn how to make the gadget work for you, and I think that's something we're still in the process of doing today with the digital devices.
Well, tell us more about that. Well, first of all, I'm interested in you saying a little bit more about conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And what that process is, you know, kind of the benefits of that that might have been lost by writing.
Yeah, there is a whole school of, a fascinating school of scholarly research and thought about what happened when the human race, most of it, ceased to be oral-based, when we gave up the oral tradition and became, you know, basically alphabet-based, when writing took off, beginning in ancient Greece. And it's too extensive a topic for me to have taken on in the book, but I do touch on, you know, basically the transition and what it meant.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, you know, there were modes of thought that were all about being in that moment where thoughts can change as they're spoken. You know how conversation, or when you're giving a public talk, it's so wonderful the way it can evolve in real time.
Mm-hmm.
And that can't happen on the page. When you've put thoughts down on a page, they can't change. Literally, the words can't change. They're frozen. And that was the thing Socrates objected to. He said, well, what good is that? In conversation, your ideas can shift in all kinds of directions and grow, and it can't happen on the page. Of course, what he didn't realize is that when you're reading something on the page, that kind of process can happen in your mind. You know, your mind can go to new places. Because he wasn't a reader, he never experienced that, so he didn't know what it would be like.
And yet it does take it out of the social realm, where the conversation now becomes an inner conversation.
Yes. However, interestingly, in the dialogue I talk about in the book with Socrates and one of his young students, Phaedrus, what they do is they take a scroll with a piece of writing on it, and they go for a walk in the country, and they have a conversation based on what's on the scroll. So even though Socrates objected to the alphabet, he was willing to use it when it served the purposes of conversation, and in this case they have really one of the greatest conversations in all of Plato with the help of this tool. So ironically, they used the tool he objected to have a fantastic talk, and even more ironically, we know about that talk today because Plato himself wrote it down.
Exactly. And so Plato was, you could say, he was the geek. He was the young geek. And he had a kind of solution, you say, that we can use to this conundrum, this informational conundrum of, you know, that Socrates had brought about of maybe TMI or different ways of thinking.
Yes. Well, what I discuss also in this chapter is the idea that Socrates was sort of an addict of the predominant connectedness of his time, which was the oral kind. He loved being in the city, mixing it up with people, having chats. But that was a very busy life. And what they do in this dialogue, he and his friend Phaedrus, is they go for a walk and put some distance between themselves and that busy world of Athens, which is really what I think is the basic principle we have to keep in mind when we're talking about any kind of connected life. Connecting is wonderful, but we need at some times to have some distance so we can take it inward and do something with all that wonderful external information and stimulation. That's what they do in the dialogue, and I think we can all do a version of that today and would be better off for it.
It's almost like a process of respiration.
Mm-hmm. In and out, in and out, or yin and yang. You know, it's all about life being better if you achieve a balance between various forces that really offset each other beautifully. You know, there's something wonderful about equilibrium in life. And to have equilibrium, you need a little of this and a little of that. For a couple decades now, we've had a lot of this, you know, the connected end of life, and less of that, the disconnected one. And I'm essentially urging readers to think again about that side of the equilibrium.
Do you think we can go back? I mean, some people think we're actually changing and molding our brains so that we are really not able to think more deeply.
Yeah, I think we can. You know, I have some doubts about that school of thought, mainly because when I realize that when I read these wonderful writers from the past, from these completely different technological eras, including Socrates himself, whose life was so different from ours in a conversation-based world, I can completely relate to what he's saying. It's as if, you know, we're peers, you know, almost as if he was speaking last week. This life doesn't change that much, and I think in the final analysis, people don't change all that much. So I really don't think that, you know, I'm out on a limb here because I'm not a neuroscientist, but I don't think we're being permanently damaged by this fixation on the screen. I just think we're getting into a mindset that is a little bit too connected, and that my experience tells me, if you put a little distance between yourself and that life regularly, all the good stuff, all those more patient and mindful ways of thinking come right back as if they've been hiding there somewhere in the recesses of your mind and you just had to release them.
And you take inspiration from these great figures of the past in developing some of those ideas of how we can achieve balance. You mentioned Seneca before.
Mm-hmm.
He talked about the restless energy of the hunted mind, mm-hmm. a very familiar kind of a thought. What was Seneca's remedy?
Seneca's remedy was, you know, it's so simple, it's almost embarrassing to say it, but we don't do it today, so it's so useful to remember. He would shut himself up in a room in busy Rome. I say shut himself up, but he wasn't shut away from the noise and chaos of Rome. In one of his letters, he writes about being over a gym, a kind of a spa, in the center of Rome where people were lifting weights and grunting and shouting at each other. Out in the street, people were selling sausages and other things. There was a noisy crowd. In that room, he decided to do an experiment to see if he could turn all that background distraction into a kind of white noise and focus on one idea. In this case, he decides to write a letter to one person and focus on that one person. And in the process of choosing that one task, instead of multitasking, as we tend to do today, and as he often did, he finds a real tranquility. He goes to this kind of place of more space and just an ability to be in that state, sometimes called flow, where you're feeling effortlessly immersed in what you're doing. You know, we've all been in that place, but I think it's harder to get there these days because of our digital distractions. And if Seneca do it, if Seneca could do it in one of the busiest lives lived in ancient Rome, he was just a tremendously busy politician. I think we can do it today. I don't think it's that hard. I've tried it myself, and I find it really works.
Just taking one idea.
One idea or one person, you know, mm-hmm. rather than updating your Facebook page and giving, you know, your 300 friends each 1 second of your time, spend time on one friend, you know, a phone call, a conversation, an in-person conversation, just that decision to focus instead of that non-decision we seem to be making every day to not focus, to multitask, to hop from A to B to C to D, then back to B, then C. It doesn't get you anywhere. You know, human beings are really not very good at multitasking. And I don't think, again, I don't think it's building us the happy life that we want.
We're talking with William Powers about achieving a balance in our digital age. His book is Hamlet's Blackberry. And then you go forward to Gutenberg, and you mentioned him before. What did the book really do?
Well, we think of the book as simply being this ingenious new form of mass production, really. You know, this product that you could only make laboriously and slowly, and that had to be sold at a high price, could suddenly be made quickly and easily and be much more affordable, and it became a uniform product. Every book looked the same. That is a wonderful achievement. But Gutenberg did something else. Before Gutenberg, reading was a very public act because most people couldn't afford books. They only experienced them in public when they were read aloud. Even more interestingly, up until roughly his time, people didn't read even when they were alone silently. They actually read books aloud even when they were by themselves. It hadn't occurred to people to read inwardly because they were coming out of a previously oral tradition. After Gutenberg, people could afford to have their own books. It became much more common to have a book you could take home and have some private time. And this idea of being by yourself with the author, reading silently, going to that wonderful space we go to when we get lost in a book, took off. You know, it was the beginning of reading as a truly inward journey. And as we know today, it's one of the richest journeys you can take. I talk about Gutenberg mainly as a way of hopefully inspiring today's technologists that we might move our digital devices more in that direction so they're less about distracting us and keeping us busy and more about helping us think.
What would that look like?
I don't know. You know, as I say in the book, I'm not a technologist and I can't, you know, design and a better iPhone. I throw out a few ideas. You know, what if you turned on your device and it asked you, how busy do you want to be? You know, do you want to be in that hectic place where you've got 10 different things happening at once? There are some situations in which we need that, really, when we're doing a task at work that requires different applications and so forth. Or do you want to be focused on one thing? If so, it could ask you, what's the one thing you want to do?
Yeah, and also in asking one, I mean, that idea of one's device asking one, it does something more. It brings to consciousness the idea that we have a choice.
Yes, and the idea that we can shape our own consciousness. You know, another of the philosophers I talk about, Henry David Thoreau, he talked about how the highest art is basically to paint the day, to be able to compose the quality of your day, to think about your consciousness and how you're perceiving it, and therefore shape your time. And I think that's a wonderful thought, and if our devices were consciously designed to help us do that, I think they'd be better.
And Thoreau, I was very interested to find out that he was living on the cusp of another terrific advance in connectivity in two ways, a telegraph and the railroad, and you really put Walden within that context.
Yeah, you know, people don't realize that when Thoreau built his famous cabin at Walden and spent 2 years there, he wasn't really running away from society. In fact, he wasn't all that far from the village of Concord, the rather busy village of Concord, where he spent most of his life. It was a short walk into town. The railroad ran right beside Walden Pond, as it still does today, so he could see the trains coming and going. And right around the same time that he ran that experiment, the telegraph came to Concord and made everybody connected to the world at large. And interestingly, I think his experiment, in fact, I don't think this, I know this, in Walden, he writes about the new philosophy of life that he was proposing, really as a reaction to those things, as an effort to bring some more balance to life so you're not constantly trying to be connected to the rest of the world and navigating all that information. He even talks about people being addicted to going to the post office.
Yeah. What would he have thought of email?
Yeah, it's a wonderful moment in Thoreau, but unfortunately a lot of people don't know about it because it's not in Walden, which is his greatest and most famous work. It's in a speech he gave that was turned into an essay. But he says, if I might read a sentence, he says, "In proportion as our inward life fails, we go more constantly and desperately to the post office."
it's so apt.
I love that. It's just like us today.
Exactly. And he also said, what was it, one person, their solitude, two people is...
Oh, yeah, no, he was talking about his cabin that he built, and he really tried to have a balanced life there. He did entertain as many as 30 people at a time in the cabin, but his life wasn't like that all the time. And the way he put it was, "I had three chairs in my house, one for solitude, two for friendship, three for society." I think that's a very inspiring thought.
Yeah. Why?
Well, because I think we could plan our own lives better that way. You know, why, when we come home after a busy day at the office, do we need to go to Facebook and spend 2 hours there? That's like just only having the three chairs for society and living that way around the clock, you know, and I think a lot of us are doing that because connectedness is so addictive for good reasons. You know, human beings are built to connect. We get a lot out of it. But we're better off, in my opinion, this is my essential argument, if we balance it with some relatively disconnected time, which is all Thoreau was trying to do in that cabin of his.
And I wonder if you're really talking about disconnected or connecting in a deeper way to different things.
Yeah, the terminology is tricky. This was one of my real challenges in the book because disconnected has a negative connotation. But I think it's beginning to take on actually a positive one. More and more I encounter people who say, "God, I'm just dying to disconnect for a while." So I actually use them as the two sides of the coin, although there is a semantic problem. But I think I did it in a way in the book that it sort of makes sense to people. But when you just use it in conversation as we have, it can sound like a negative. I mean it as a positive. I do mean it, in fact. Disconnectedness is simply a deeper way of connecting, and a wonderful one.
Then you go to Marshall McLuhan, who I'm sure many of our young listeners may not know who he was, but he was a towering figure when I was young. His great phrases are "the global village" and "the medium is a message." So tell us about McLuhan. What was the world he saw so penetratingly?
Well, McLuhan was wonderful because he saw in the middle of the 20th century, you know, when radio and television were really changing everyday life, he saw that this was having a dramatic impact on the individual, that it wasn't just the messages that were being delivered, you know, the news and, you know, what you heard on the radio and so forth that mattered. It was actually the potential that devices had to just immerse us in stimuli and information all the time, and that could really affect our consciousness in a negative way. Overload, basically, before anyone had coined that term of information overload, he was talking about it. And what the beauty of McLuhan is A, that he saw this problem and sort of diagnosed it. B, that he took it to the public and really raised consciousness about it. He became a huge pop culture icon, really. He was on variety shows, on network television. Everybody knew his name at the time, which I think is fantastic. He was sort of the equivalent of these celebrity chefs we have today. The other great thing about McLuhan is he was an optimist. He believed that we all have the power within us to take that information overload that we're immersed in because of technology and really take control of it, take control of our lives, design our lives wisely so that we're not constantly at the mercy of our connectedness, but instead are using it to its fullest potential. And I found that so inspiring because he really lived just on the doorstep of the digital age and in many ways predicted it. And so I looked to him as someone who said, just as we were setting off on this path, it can be a wonderful path if you just are smart about it.
Marshall McLuhan differentiated between what he called hot and cold media.
If using your BlackBerry for 8 straight hours during the day has kind of heated up your mind to the point where you can almost feel the steam coming out of your scalp, maybe you can cool it down by using a cooler device. You know, reading a traditional book might be one. I find the radio itself is a wonderful cooling mechanism because it's only audio, so it's not overloading all my senses. Everyone's different, you know, and there's going to be different approaches for each person. I try to make the book not prescriptive, but simply consciousness-raising so that everyone can be inspired perhaps to design their own media lives.
Now, so talking about prescriptions, you do have some suggestions.
I think there are simple solutions that anyone can try, and the most useful one is simply organizing time. Setting aside times of the day, days of the week, when you're either less connected or, if you're lucky, if you can pull this off, completely offline, so that you can have one of these gaps between your busy digital life and the rest of existence, which I think has a lot to offer us and that we're missing out on these days. My family, we're into the fourth year now of disconnecting from the internet on weekends. Saturday and Sunday we are offline as a family. We unplug the household modem, and it's just made a huge difference for us. It really brought that balance that we needed and has improved not just our weekends together, but our connected lives are more enjoyable because we have 2 days off.
And was that difficult at first?
Really, really hard at first. I have to admit, I'd like to say it was easy, but we had complete withdrawal at first. Really almost existential, you know, crisis, because you don't realize how dependent you've become on the constant, you know, checking and confirmation that you get, self-confirmation that you get from the inbox and from the busyness of the internet. So yes, the first few weekends, I would say almost the first few months of doing it, we were really discombobulated and weren't sure we were going to make it. But once we got over the hump, it was amazing. The kind of the new way of looking at our lives that opened up, and the reminder that we'd been kind of running away from each other to the screen and not spending the kind of time together that you really should spend when you're in a home. We started to have eye contact again. We'd almost lost the art of eye contact. Wow. In my house, and that's a terrible thing. All kinds of stuff came rushing back, and it wasn't just about togetherness either. We find it's easier to go off and be alone when we're in a house that's not connected to the internet. So those weekends have been magical for us. It wouldn't work for everyone. There's many people who can't disconnect on the weekend for work reasons or whatever, but perhaps there are a few hours during the week when they could try it just as an experiment. It all begins with trial and error, and everyone's solution is going to be different.
William Powers, your wonderful book is Hamlet's Blackberry, A Practical Philosophy for Building a Good Life in the Digital Age. Thanks so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
William Powers writes about the information age. He's covered business, politics, and popular culture for The Washington Post, and his work has appeared in The Atlantic, The New York Times, The Guardian, and other publications. You can find an excerpt from Hamlet's Blackberry at writersvoice.net. Coming up, we talk with Joanne Cantor about conquering cyber overload. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. The New York Times recently published a report about how growing up with digital media is wiring kids' brains for distraction, making them unable to focus on one thing at a time. But it's not just kids. Most of us, myself included, think we can multitask, cramming more stuff into less time. But my next guest, Joanne Cantor, says we're fooling ourselves. In fact, we're less productive. In her book, Conquer Cyber Overload, Cantor shows us how to declutter our digital domains and free our minds to become more creative and productive with less stress. Well, Joanne Cantor, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Glad to be with you.
Now, you are a professor at the University of Wisconsin. You've been working with children, but now you've turned your pen and your mind to something that affects a whole lot of adults, perhaps even more than children.
Mm-hmm.
How did you come to turn your attention to that?
Well, it was partly because I was experiencing these problems myself. The problem that I was constantly connected to my gadgets, and I not only wasn't getting as much done as I had been before, but frankly, I felt like I was losing my memory. I couldn't remember things as well as I had before. Things would go out of my mind, and I was under a lot of stress. And that's when I thought, I better get into the research on how the mind functions when it's being exposed to multiple inputs. And I discovered that all the research was showing that my reactions were typical. And I decided to really devote full time to this topic rather than just children. Although children, I think, are experiencing the same problems.
Yeah, they are. Maybe a little bit later we can talk about the impact on children and on the developing brain. But as you say, so you were beginning to notice that you were actually losing your ability to remember things. Is this short-term memory that you're talking about?
Well, not exactly short-term memory. Well, some of it was short-term memory, but some of it was just not being able to focus and not being able to concentrate without moving on to something else. But it was also the short-term thing about walking into a room and forgetting why you walked into the room and going out again and coming back. And frankly, I was thinking, well, maybe this was early Alzheimer's. But as soon as I started cutting back on this connectivity, my mind came back to me, and in fact, now that I follow my own advice, I feel like my mind is sharper than it was 20 years ago.
Wow. So this would be one symptom. You also have 5 questions in the book that you present to people to ask themselves whether they might be suffering from cyber overload. What are some of those questions?
Well, do you find yourself getting less done now that you have constant access to limitless information? When you're in the middle of a conversation or a meeting, is it difficult for you not to take that cell phone call or check your BlackBerry? When you're trying to get something done, is it hard for you to stop going online to see the latest in what's happening in the world? Do entertainment and news programs leave you feeling agitated and stressed out rather than informed and entertained? And finally, are you so busy and so attached to technology that you don't even have time to think? And I think this time to think is very important.
Tell us what's going on in the brain. Why do you think you are getting distracted, losing your ability to remember things? What is happening exactly to us when we're on these, or when we're connected all the time?
Well, our brains are designed to focus on one thing at a time. That is, focus our attention on one thing at a time. We can scan the environment, and we're very susceptible to any kind of distraction that comes along, but we can really only focus on one thing at a time. And that seems odd because we have billions and billions of neurons. But there's something that you alluded to, and that is short-term memory, sometimes called working memory, and that's the small amount of information that we can focus on acutely at one time. And so when we try to multitask, which is one thing that we seem to always be doing now because our computers let us do 10 things at a time, when we try to multitask, we can't. Our brain just switches back and forth between the two tasks, and every time we do that, we lose time, and we lose quality. So when you're writing something and then you suddenly check your email and you may respond to that email or maybe you just look at it and decide to look at it later, you lose that focus on what you were writing. And particularly for writers, writers need to use that working memory not just to be working on the stream of words that you're currently writing down, but to keep in mind what you just said in the previous sentence and where you're going in the subsequent sentence, and how that all fits into the big picture. And when we multitask, we lose that ability to put whatever we're doing in the context that's going to make it meaningful. So we're, you know, we can multitask at some very low level, but we're using our brain at an inferior level, and the product turns out to be much inferior to what we would do. And also, we end up taking twice as much time. So we're losing in both timeliness and in quality.
Well, as you're talking, I'm thinking about the process I go through. In addition to this radio show, I also write about sustainability issues for a number of online publications. And I find I'm constantly going back and forth between my sentence, my paragraphs, and then saying, oh, I have to find a link for this. So then I go on the web and I surf the web, and then I have a hard time really getting back to the flow that you're talking about. And just this week, I decided I was going to just put a little asterisk and get back to the links later.
That's an excellent idea, and that's the kind of thing I'm talking about. And those are the kinds of tips I put in Conquer Cyber Overload, because obviously, this is a problem for everybody, and you're not going to give up all of these computer linkages and everything that give you information. But if you take just a few steps, you can benefit from all of this information without losing your focus and without drowning in it. And another thing that happens because of all this accessibility of links is there's always more information that you can have. When I wrote this book, it was much more of a problem. When I wrote my first book, which was a parenting book about children and TV, it was really before the Internet was that available. So I had to go to the library and get books and whatever. But then when I had the information I wanted, I sat down and wrote it. Here, every day, something else came up in the Internet that might have been a good thing to add into my book. But at some point, you have to stop and say, I've got the information I need. I've got to step back from it and make sense of it, rather than just continuing to wander off into various nooks and crannies of the Internet. And that's a challenge.
Now, some people are saying, well, you know, our brains can adapt. Mm-hmm. They're infinitely, or maybe not infinitely plastic, but they're very plastic. You know, that maybe this is just a transition problem, that as we, you know, young people coming up today will be able to multitask better. What do you think of this?
Yes. Well, it is true that our brains are plastic, and that means everything we encounter affects our brains. We learn new things every day, but our brains don't evolve very quickly. Our brains are still going to have these billions and billions of neurons, and they're still going to have a limited short-term memory capacity. We can perhaps get used to multitasking, but we shouldn't count on getting better, partly because some really interesting research done in Stanford last year showed that people who multitask a lot are not better at multitasking than people who hardly ever multitask. In fact, they're worse at it. So people who multitask a lot don't do it because they're more effective. They seem to do it because maybe they're bored or they just want more stimulation. So it may be that over the millennia, our brains will evolve to a new form, but we should not count on the younger generation coming to a point where they multitask better than they single task. But there is one thing that is different about the younger generation, and that is young people have a greater working memory capacity. So, and that is a function of, not because of the Internet, but just because that's how the brain develops over time. And our peak of working memory is about the age of 25. And after that, it's our working memory starts a slow decline. But for young people, they can still single task much better than they can multitask. So when you are multitasking, no matter what your age, it's as if you're tying one hand behind your back, or you're working with your left hand when you're right-handed. Sure, you can get better at using your left hand, but as long as your right hand, you know, is not broken or hasn't been amputated, you're much better off using your right hand.
We're talking with Joanne Cantor about her book, Conquer Cyber Overload. It's filled with useful tips for those of us, and that's probably most of us, who are struggling to tame our addiction to connectivity and to find ways to be more productive. Now, I took your, on your website, I took your colors test, which is one that I've actually also seen for helping to diagnose people with ADD.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that I could do the first few pretty well, and then I got slower and slower. Explain to us what this test is and what it looks like and what it's testing.
Okay. This is called the Stroop test, a classic psychological test in which you are shown words that refer to colors, like the word is green, but the color that the letters appear in is a different color. So the word green is shown in an orange color, and the word orange is shown in a green color. And the person being tested is supposed to, as soon as they can, call out not what the word says, but what the colors of the letters. And this is hard to do because once we learn how to read, our first reaction is to just read the word. So what we have to do is inhibit that first reaction and then step back and say, no, I'm supposed to do this. In a sense, it's switching modes in your brain. And what this illustrates is the difficulty of task switching and also the stress involved in task switching. We have something called executive function in the brain, which tells us what to pay attention to and also what to inhibit. And this relates to the question of multitasking, because what we're doing all the time is reacting quickly to the next thing that comes in and losing the focus on what happened before. And I use this, I give workshops for people in organizations and businesses and also students to try to explain to them what they're up against if they let their gadgets dominate themselves. And I always include these brain exercises like this one and a few others so they can feel from the inside how difficult it is, and they can also learn it's not that they're inadequate that they can't do this. It's that this is the way human brains work. So rather than trying harder and harder to do this, what they should do is arrange their environment in a way that suits their brains better.
And, of course, everybody's brain is different. I'm sure some people are going to be better at this than others, even if they are connected. What are some of the suggestions that you would give to people? And of course, there are two problems here. One is distraction, and one is too much information.
That's right. Well, I have different sets of information different sets of strategies that are sort of interconnected. First of all, if you want to get something done, try to find a time when you can focus on that one thing and avoid all the interruptions, which means turn off your email, turn off your voicemail, etc., and just focus on this one thing, even if it's only for a short period of time. Even if you only focus for 15 minutes and then check your email and then go back for another 15 minutes, you'll be so much better off than if you just let both things happen. Because multitasking, as I said before, not only slows you down, but it really lowers your intellectual capacity. So one of the problems, of course, is, are you afraid that there's going to be some emergency calling you? And so before you do this, you have to work out a way for those emergency people to get in touch with you. So I call these people your drop-everything contacts. Maybe it's your sick mother or your child at school. But the way we are now, we are set up so that everybody can reach us at any time, and we have to change that. So that's the one thing. Give yourself swaths of uninterruptible time and then take breaks, not when other people decide they want to get in touch with you, but when it's a logical time in what you're working on. Maybe you finished a paragraph or a chapter if you're writing. But the other thing that is so difficult is it's not just interruptions from other people. It's interruptions from yourself, because you may be working on your computer and suddenly you say, oh my gosh, I was supposed to get a present for my niece. And you say, oh, well, it's right here online. I'll just drop this and go off and, you know, order this thing. It'll only take me 5 minutes and I'll come back. And so you have to learn to be a little disciplined for yourself. And if you're afraid, for example, that you're going to forget it again, then have a pencil and paper next to your computer and jot down those random thoughts that are going to carry you off in directions you didn't mean to go, and then come back to those later. So, you know, part of the problem is that the Internet is so tantalizing and so compelling, and we can find out the sports score right now, and we don't want to wait. But if we can, one of the things that I have observed and I have heard from people that I have spoken to and have gotten back to me is that once you try this focus for a period of time, it works so well that it's self-rewarding, self-reinforcing, and people try it again and again. So they may start it for 15 minutes, but they'll expand it to an hour. And, you know, another thing is, you know, if you can't turn off your email entirely, set it to check for new messages every half hour or every hour rather than every minute, which is the default position. So those are the kinds of things that you can do to overcome these constant interruptions that are due either to multitasking or other people.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Joanne Cantor about her book, Conquer Cyber Overload. Now, in your book, you also talk about how to become more creative. I mean, I think a lot of us think that, you know, if we multitask and we go online, we will be more creative. But you say, no, that's not so.
Yes. You need to go online when you're gathering information. But the research on creativity shows that taking breaks from getting new input allows the brain to sort through what you've already learned. And some of the most recent research on creativity is astounding. First of all, you should work really hard and focus on what you're doing. And then when you hit an impasse, you don't know where to go next, you should stop and take a break, not to TV or the Internet, but to a low information environment. And one of the really good environments for this is the natural environment, looking at trees or water or something like that. Albert Einstein used to say that he would work really hard on a math problem, and when he would get stuck, he would go sailing. And the answer often came to him when he was on the water. And other people have noticed that maybe they're working on something and then they go take a shower, and in the shower the answer comes. Or they go for a walk.
Yeah, I was going to say my remedy is a walk, because it seems the combination of the low information environment and the physical activity.
Absolutely, and research on the brain shows that physical activity brings more oxygen to the brain, and it also promotes better connections between neurons. So my second piece of advice is to walk around. And the third area, which I think is really astounding, is the area of sleep. The new research on sleep shows that when you are sleeping, your brain is not resting. Your brain is actually trying to make sense of what it is you were doing during the day. And so things that are kind of complicated and disconnected before you go to sleep become sorted out, and the brain is actually trying to figure out where things fit together. And that's why so many people wake up in the morning with the next step in the problem they were trying to solve. And that has happened to me a tremendous amount. But they've done this in systematic research where they showed that they gave people a problem to start solving, and then they either slept or they stayed awake for the same period of time. And the people who slept during the break not only solved the problem faster, they found more creative solutions. And I find this when I'm either writing or working on an article or a speech, I will always wake up in the morning with new ideas that are good. And so I have started keeping a paper and pencil next to my bed. Now that I know that these are good ideas that are coming to me, these aren't wacky things out of my dreams, sometimes, you know, titles of chapters and titles of blogs and the first sentences come to me, and that's because your brain is trying to make sense of all of this stuff. Because what creativity really is not inventing something entirely new out of nowhere. Many people say creativity is making connections between two things you already knew but didn't realize were connected. And the brain allows these things to just kind of sort through, and these things come out. And some of the brain research also shows that when people are trying to solve an insight problem, they call these insight problems are things where you suddenly see it, you get an aha experience. They look at the activity in the brain, and people's brains are just active in one small area when they're trying to do it. But just before they get the insight, they notice that another distant area of the brain lights up, and there's a connection between those two. And I think if you keep yourself focused on this problem without breaking away at all, you're continuing to look in one place. And when you back off and maybe take a walk or look at nature, which is just mildly stimulating, it allows you to relax that focus on that place where you thought the answer was, and suddenly something pops up in your brain far away, and those two things get connected. So it's as important to break away as it is to focus. And one of the things that I feel is so nice about the conclusions of my book is that the things that are really going to make you a better writer and a better achiever and getting ahead and getting things done and more creative are the things that also feel good and that are good for you physically, like exercise and nature and sleep.
Well, the book is Conquer Cyber Overload, Get More Done, Boost Your Creativity, and Reduce Stress. Thanks so much, Joanne Cantor, for talking with us.
Thank you.
Joanne Cantor is Outreach Director for the Center for Communication Research at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. Go to writersvoice.net to find links to the Stanford Research Study about multitasking and to take the Stroop test to see how you do. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Be sure to visit us at writersvoice.net to find out who's coming on next week, listen to archive shows, and leave your comments and suggestions. That's www.writersvoice.net. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.